Come, light divine, our souls inspire. Your word, your birth, our desire. Amen. You don't need to be a Bible scholar to find out that the prophet Isaiah did not say that a virgin shall conceive. Ancient Hebrew has a word for virgin, but Isaiah chose another one that means young woman. And he spoke not of a young woman, you just heard this, but rather the young woman, which suggests that he knew the young woman of whom he spoke. And if it's your guess that the young woman he had in mind was his wife, you may feel the need of some Bible scholars to back you up. And you know what? You can find them by the dozen. When I went to seminary, questions like these were burning in my mind. I felt a passion to get to the bottom of this, to understand what had happened, how Matthew had made a new meaning from an ancient oracle of Isaiah. And I felt troubled that most Christians seemed unaware of or in denial about these differences, these processes. I was eager for the tools of what's sometimes called the higher criticism or the historical critical methods. And in that first fall of my study, some 30 years ago, the scholars we read quickly laid things bare. It was around 750 BC. The northern kingdom of Israel had made an alliance with Syria, its traditional enemy, to attack Jerusalem and the surrounding tribe of Judah, to attack them, hoping to get rid of King Ahaz and to force that army of Judah in Jerusalem to support them in their effort to rebel against the superpower of the day, Assyria. King Ahaz was terrified at this onslaught from cousin Israel and from Syria to the north. Isaiah wrote of Ahaz, the first line or two of the seventh chapter, "His heart and the heart of the people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind." He was terrified. Ahaz wanted military help against these enemies coming at his border. And so he was about to send an embassy to the superpower. Gee, they never do that in this world, do they? To the superpower to get military support. Well, right at this moment, Isaiah, the prophet of Judah and Jerusalem, came to the king. They were known to one another. And he warned Ahaz not to deal with any foreign powers. No entangling alliances, he might have said, but rather to trust in the Lord. Isaiah pressed Ahaz to seek from the Lord a sign of the promise of God's constancy to Judah. But Ahaz refused to believe that God could have anything to do with the serious dangers of war. This prompted Isaiah's famous Emmanuel prophecy. It wouldn't be too simple to summarize it like this. Isaiah says to Ahaz, "As sure as it is that my wife will conceive and give birth to a son, as sure as it is the day is coming when that boy will know good from evil, just that sure is it that God is with us in war. We are going to name our son Emmanuel. We're going to name our son God is with us as a sign of this certainty, this faith. that God is with us. And so Isaiah and his wife had a son. And at his birth, Isaiah received from God another oracle. Name that boy. And the complicated name, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, I'm not sure I got that right, but it means, translated, the spoil speeds and the plunder hastens. In other words, says God through Isaiah, sooner than a child will learn to say mommy, Damascus and Samaria to the north, these enemies will be destroyed by Assyria. That is the story behind the song that goes like this. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name. I got this tune wrong, but you know what I'm saying. Emmanuel, God with us. That beautiful song from Handel's Messiah comes down to us, but now we can say it. What Isaiah meant and what Matthew meant seem so very different. Did Matthew bend his Bible too far? When I was in seminary, I thought so. It might be that Harry Emerson Fosdick thought so. Some of you may know where I'm going. In 1922, about 7 years before John D. Rockefeller Jr. persuaded finally Reverend Fosdick to come and inaugurate this pulpit. Yeah, this pulpit. In 1922, preaching at the First Presbyterian Church in Greenwich Village in Manhattan, Fosdick delivered a sermon and embraced a teaching that belief in the virgin birth is not essential to Christian faith. Now, the local church was thrilled by this teaching. But the gray eminences of the denomination, the Presbyterian denomination, felt that his teaching was going to threaten the whole edifice of Christianity unless it were stopped. And they mustered their forces, and they meant to overthrow him. Although it was a battle without ordinary violence, it was harsh and cruel. Bitter. The well-known sermon, "Shall the Fundamentalists Win," of Fosdick, came out of that conflict. You could say a conflict over whether there was a virgin birth, but it was a much bigger question than that. Really, the question is how to know what is true. Who has that authority? Has it been held by science in a new way? Is it held still by the church or yet by other authorities? This is modernism itself, a flame in New York City and all over the country in the 1920s. And I ask you now, take a step back with me as we paint in very broad strokes the early 20th century. That time was the morning of the age of science, the dawning of this new way of seeing, touching virtually every human being. Oh, there had been scientists down through 2 to 3 centuries, but mostly what they did and said did not affect the average woman and man. That time, the early 20th century, gave birth to this church, and no matter how new influences have changed the church through 80-some years, still, it is wise that we know our DNA, our inheritance, where we came from. Think back to the 1920s when this extraordinary cathedral was under construction. Then, in a generation's time had come electric lights, telephones, automobiles, the radio, movies, winged flight with men. And when did Amelia Earhart fly? Maybe women in the pilot seat. There came rumblings from physics. E equals mc squared. What did it mean? You could not overstate how the world of science altered the culture of this nation. The awesome slaughter of World War I was just past. This, indeed, had dimmed the hopes of poets and prophets that anything good could come from humanity. But the war itself had shifted the power balance toward white America. And white America was thrilled by its burgeoning wealth all through that decade of the 20s. So one could say that from religion and its high priests, science had wrested the authority to say what is so. Science had shown that it could reveal what had been hidden from long ages. Science edged into what some have called God of the gaps, giving less and less and less ambit for theories of God's particular action. No, we were understanding one thing and then another. What is hidden was revealed. The power to know was put in human hands. In this sense, science offered liberation from oppression of the mind, oppression of dogma, from the notion that all people in the church think the same thing. If there's 400 or 500 of you in a room at once, are there not actually 400 or 500 Christianities? That would not have been quite safe to say 100 years ago. Many have embraced these new powers of thought, of freedom. Many have fled from them into various ideologies, to be sure. But this church was founded by modernists who thrilled to use their freedom to think a thing through to the end. Oh, certainly there's a kind of hubris in it. But there's also something essential in human power to be able so to attend to a matter, to understand it, to see what is really real. And in this, you know, science and religion share a likeness. They ought to see in one another a kind of family resemblance, a yearning to go to the end of things. I've often said that good science and good religion share a behavior, which is to keep asking questions, and bad science and bad religion share a behavior, which is to decide when to stop asking questions. So I think it is good when the religious relax about this aspect of science, this yearning to know. There is nothing that can be revealed which doesn't show. Religion and science can embrace, though their purposes differ. Therefore, to lay the axe at the root of magic and miracle, which seems so dangerous and so troubling and caused those Presbyterian elders of nearly 100 years ago to bring down all the force of power they could to get Fosdick run right out of First Presbyterian Church. They failed, by the way. But to lay the axe at the root of magical, miracle-type thinking seems to some to shake the very tree of religious faith and all its possible fruits to fall from the ground. But there are many faithful who will attest that when that tree is lying prone upon the ground, a tree of magical thinking, it can be seen for what it was, a kind of idol, a god, a thing from which to carve gods. In fact, it can be seen that the imagined god was made to dance and sing for us on a stage of our own making. And so feel, by contrast, the thrill of the revolution experienced by the architects of these very columns. Yes, the literal architects, but the people who thrilled to this church nearly 100 years ago, hoping that our minds might come free to ask whatever question comes and to listen according to discernment, to science, or for God. Hoping that either way we might learn to take our crown. And then came the rest of the 20th century. Science dreamed impossible dreams. Science made the impossible bomb and dropped it impossibly. Hitler planned a final solution scientifically. Stalin and Mao and Pol Pot, I suppose, impassioned by the science of dialectical materialism, I think they thought, slaughtered millions of men and women on the way to their scientific solutions. America began to destroy every revolution everywhere that threatened the flow of money to capitalists. America let lynching and torture flourish at home and abroad, anywhere, in order to dim the hopes of change and to divide people by color and by class. Oh, very good things happened also at the cost of much blood in the last century. And the course of this century is not set. But surely we have to pause. Incomprehensible is the slaughter of humanity since 1940. More humans dead in these decades than were wasted in all the wars of all lands from all history before. We have become so violent, and science is a tool thereof. Every single person murdered at the hands of politics and war was murdered because someone believed, it's a kind of faith, someone believed they could only have peace if they hung on to this or that or the other thing. And so killed. You know, under that shut lid of belief that I must have my way or I cannot be at peace, under that shut lid of belief in power and greed, science cannot get its lever and cannot shed its light. For those in whom hunger for more for themselves goes unregulated, science, like religion, brings neither salvation nor solution, but only becomes a tool for advancing a hideous strength. science has its way of seeing. And may the human species never abandon the power of that way of seeing. We have seen too many politicians too ready to abandon that way of seeing and have a kind of politics by faith or something like that. And it is its own delusion to refuse to use the science mind, which I will now say, which God gives us. Science cannot save us. Indeed, science will damn us to a hot hell if not regulated by this other kind of seeing, of which we'll speak presently. Look how the geoscientists and the politicians collude these days to suck from the bowels of the earth more oil than air is available to burn it, and send the whole earth, all things great and small, into that hot hell. No, science is no salvation and no solution. Whoever sees that we shall not be saved from ourselves by science knows then that we are at the close of the age of science, which seemed to so many Americans but dawning 100 years ago. Something new must come, and with it must come a new politics and a new religion. Times like these are times to look deep into the waters from which we have come. Sometimes they're in the deepest waters, which are the waters held in the vessels of the world's religions. These are, without question, the deepest waters in which humanity has life. There we can see truths that we discarded when we were in our revolutionary fervor about change and power and authority. There, in those waters, it is possible to look again and see whether Matthew was forever right to bend the Bible in the way he did, and see the story of Christ Jesus to a virgin born. Not because Matthew had it from a doctor attending Mary, not because he had it from God dictated, not because 'twas Isaiah foretold it. Isaiah didn't foretold it. No, ask this. What if Matthew was right to bend the Bible as he did, because he saw that only what is hidden can save us. Only what is revealed to us, not by our own will, but by a power we have no word for. We call it God. Only what is given, not what is taken, can save us. Unto us a child is given. Only what is given can save us. Only that can bless us and grace us with peace. Yet not as the world gives peace does God give. Only the story of the child given to us can take us out of our furious desire to add more to ourselves. Whatever else you receive from the Christmas stories, do not miss this. The baby is incognito. Basically, nobody gets what's going on unless it is revealed to them. right? That's there in all the stories. The baby is just a baby. He looks like one more baby from one more coupling, maybe married, maybe not. The world doesn't see anything unusual at all. There are no fireworks to make everybody understand. There's, frankly, not even the story of the star makes everybody understand. On the contrary, it's all just a dark night. And another birth to another poor couple to the world. That's all that they can see. That's all that science can see, the measurable. There is no fine birth. There are no heralds. There's no rich clothing. There's no pedigree. Just this unmarried girl with a big belly. And Joseph feeling jilted, if a bit gentle about it. So, how he came to see it differently, that's the story we heard this morning. It's full of silences. In a dream, by an angel, what is that? How he came to see it differently, how he came to give the boy the name Jesus, which in his language means he will save. Do you know that? When they write that on the train trestles, Jesus saves, it's redundant. How this came, by a dream. This wasn't science. This isn't that way of knowing. It's a totally other way of knowing. And in this world, these ways of knowing can abide together. In the emptiness of a dream, in the midst of something like despair, Joseph had it revealed to him, says the story, revealed by a messenger of God, the story of salvation from a virgin birth. Tells us again what we must always return to, which is emptiness. God comes to nothing. For creatures on earth, the animal as well as the witting animal, the humans, what has not appeared as possible is in fact not possible. For power to emerge in our hands, we have to see it as possible. Only that which has appeared in awareness comes into existence. Everything else is hidden for as long as it is unseen. And yet, as Augustine wrote somewhere, many have sought light and truth, but they look outside themselves where it is not. That was written 1600 years ago. And he identifies with it this same divide we're talking about today. The sciences have sought light and truth, but they look outside themselves where it is not. What was revealed to Matthew, the evangelist, what was revealed to Matthew, science can't see. Science looks only to things outside. But the truth of God comes to us always hidden within in emptiness. God only comes in secret to give life in secret, to give life wholly, spiritually. Matthew knew how Christ had come alive in himself, holy, hidden, human. Matthew told his story right. Oh, yes, Matthew told his story right. God comes holy, hidden, human. Matthew told how God comes. For this reason, we tell again and again, year on year, the story that moves from empty womb to empty tomb, the story which begins, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name God is with us." You have the room in which God is waiting to give birth. This is not inconceivable. This is possible. Amen.